Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. Today, we're covering a subject which is very close to my heart. This podcast is something I've been wanting to do ever since I met one of my guests while working on a TV show I make about big machines. This guy changed my understanding about the history of car engineering and its future.
We always worry about how we're going to dispose of tire carcasses. Nobody ever asks, why is it a carcass? Well, it's because there's an awful lot of it missing around the edge, the tread. Where's it gone? Nobody ever asks where
the British countryside,
gone.
Yeah.
Or it's in the snow in the Arctic when they take out their snow samples and they're full of rubbers and plastic.
To help me unpack the past, the present and the future of cars and sustainability in a fascinating way are Hugo Spowers, who is the design mastermind behind Rivers Simple, who are pioneering the next generation of zero-emission vehicles which use hydrogen, not batteries, and emit nothing but water. Hugo argues that hydrogen-powered cars are the future, and he's going to tell us why. Alongside Hugo is Richard Sutton. Richard presented Deals on Wheels on Channel 4, and he also worked at Goodwood for years. He's been immersed in cars all his life. He's also a friend of Hugo's, and he's helping me put car engineering and Hugo's vision into context today.
Every time a new model comes out, the buyer of that model wants something that's bigger and bolder and more thoroughly equipped than the previous version. And so you end up with a Mini today that is incomparably larger than a Mini that came out in 1959. A bigger Mini now is bigger than a Volvo estate in the 60s.
Anyway, before we get to that, here's Melissa, my producer. She's here for a chat. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Tony. I remember well when you met Hugo, you were absolutely blown away by that day, weren't you? And you said to me, we've got to get this guy on the podcast.
He's a visionary, but he's not like a woolly-minded visionary. He's a very smart thinker. He understands about cars and the science behind what he's trying to do down in Mid Wales is, I think, absolutely incredible. I think you'll find that your mind will be changed by this podcast, which is, I know, an audacious thing to say, but what he and Richard are saying is revolutionary.
My interest is piqued. We're going to hear it all. I mean, obviously, we are told that electric cars are the future, but you are telling me that he's saying hydrogen cars are the future. So, wow.
Battery cars are the future. That's what we've been told.
Mm.
And now, yes, we're saying that hydrogen cars are the future, or if not the complete future, a massive component of it.
And of course, to understand the future, as you do, Tony, you're a historian. Mm. We're going back into the past. That's why it is a cunning cast today,
because
we're going to put it in context, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to think about was why we've got where we are today, why we've got all these problems as far as cars are concerned today. Could there be alternatives to what's being suggested in the future? I think it's one of the more exciting podcasts we've ever made.
So exciting. Make sure then you just get right back into the past. I'm sure Hugo will know a lot about the history. Can't wait to hear it.
We'll start at the very beginning. The reason that I wanted to do this podcast was I was walking home fairly recently. My street is in West London. It's about 100 houses and each one probably four or five flats. So let's say at a conservative estimate, 200 cars, and there are 12 charging points, probably room for another 10 more. And I started thinking to myself, how are people practically going to charge their cars? Are they going to have rubber tubes dangling out from their top windows five floors up? How are they going to push other people off the charger, which inevitably is going to take a large amount of time? Is this actually a plot to ensure that there are no cars in West London? So my cunning plan is to look a little bit at the history of the motor car, see how we got to where we've got to today, and then see what kind of futures are possible, if there is a possible future for the motor car, which is why I got you two in, because you're two of the most opinionated people I know on the subject of motor cars. So let me ask you both, did it have to be petrol? When the car was first invented, did we have to go down the petrol route?
Well, until about 1905, arguably a bit later, it was a three-horse race and it wasn't clear who was going to be the winner. It was steam, battery electric or petrol. And the problem was with batteries that even more than now, they were big and heavy and so you couldn't build a car to go very far. Steam, it took you half an hour to get steam up. And whereas petrol engines, of course, you can start quickly. The problem with petrol is that you tend to break your arm or your wrist when you tried to start it. And so that was a real problem for them.
In the 19th century, the land speed record was broken six times, and all six times by an electric car. So, I mean, the internal combustion engine wasn't even featuring at that point. So it was only really at the turn of the century it kicked in. And then we had a couple of steam car interlopers, 1903, I think, and 1906.
Well, the steam car broke the land speed record too.
Twice, yeah. 1903 and 1906. Yeah.
This is what I don't get. If this is the case, why did the manufacturers go, oh, well, never mind those people who are breaking the world record. I'll go for petrol instead.
Well, there's a technical answer, really, and that is that batteries, especially in those days, were very big and heavy, so you couldn't go very far. And it took half an hour to start your steam car. Petrol, you could get plenty of range out of it, and you could start it quickly. Mm. The problem was that you often broke your arm or your wrist doing so. And so the big turning point, really, was the invention of the starter motor. It made it altogether more practical and you didn't hurt yourself and didn't get messy.
So even in my lifetime, I remember people had a little hole in the front of the car and they would shove that cranky thing in and try and go round and round and round.
Yes.
Yeah. It's about 1914, 15, something like that. First ones.
Before the First World War.
But they weren't regularly around for a long time. Yeah. Interestingly as well, with electric cars in America, in up to about 1904, 1905, a third of the cars on the road were electric. And they were very popular, allegedly, for the ladies, which is odd because they weren't sort of the natural driving market at that point. But I think that was more about silence and lack of smell and commotion and general drama than they were
150 years ahead of their time. Yeah, really, yeah. Wouldn't they?
Well, Clara Ford, who was Henry's wife, drove an electric car to her dying day, not a Model T.
You've effortlessly got us to Henry Ford. How long was it after the invention of the motor car before we started to get mass production?
The Model T was just an explosive success from 1907 or so, but the scale at which he ramped it up and the volume production was unbelievable. But he eclipsed everything else that was happening anywhere else in the world.
How was he able to do that? Was he just backed by a lot of money?
He was backed by a lot of money. He had a very good product. Competitively, it was an extremely solid, simple car, easy to repair, and it just worked. I mean, amazingly, he paid over the odds for his workforce. I mean, he famously wanted to pay above market rates. And he argued very strongly that this creates the disposable income to buy his cars. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy. And talk about the growth dream in America. He was actually at the birth of it. 20th century personal freedom machine. as I've seen referred to, that you can just get in, fire it up, and off you go.
But at the same time that that was happening, there were some real innovators in Europe, weren't there?
Yeah, I mean the French were really the whiz kids in the early years, and were doing all kinds of wonderful things. And with the British, and to some extent the Americans as well, in terms of competition and driving the envelope of development, the Brits were very to the fore, not least in speed records and things of that nature.
The Europeans were better at the performance end. We took a lot longer to get geared up for volume production. And in fact, Ford opened their plants over here because we were so behind. Then along came Austin and Morris and people like that with the Austin 7 and the Morris Cowley. And we did get into volume production, but we were a lot slower at it. But we were always much better in France and the UK and in Italy by the 20s at the performance end of the market and the Americans.
In the 20s and 30s, there were far more car manufacturers around than there are nowadays, weren't there?
Well, I think everything was a bit more agricultural. So, you know, all the manufacturing processes and the logic were just easier to put together. Having said that, I think the art of building cars at that time had its background in coach building as much as anything. There was much more craftsmanship involved. There was much more personalization involved. And it was a much more romantic thing to do. And of course, it was a thing largely for the privileged few, because you still had to have quite a lot of money even to have something really basic in the 20s. And that, of course, changed dramatically after the war when construction methods changed and so on.
And there was a gulf between a Model T Ford and the more upmarket cars that the smaller manufacturers made. I mean, I think there were over 500 independent auto manufacturers in the early 20s in America. There are three now. So, yeah, so we were a very large number. But they were turning out very small numbers of very expensive cars generally. It took a long time before anybody could really compete with Ford.
The Second World War must have been a real boon for most car manufacturers. They were just being asked to make more and more stuff, weren't they?
I think what's really interesting about the Second World War period is that afterwards there was one or two years where everyone was trying just to rally from the atrocities of the time. And then there was some blindingly major progress, very progressive things done by a number of manufacturers. And the difference between a sort of a 1949 model or a 48 model and a 1950 or 51 model is huge.
What were those blinding things? What kind of things?
You suddenly had a very modern car. Up to that point, it was a pre-war car that was warmed over, basically. But then they'd had a couple of years of development and they were able to do some really remarkable things. And that's the cars like a Jaguar XK120, for example, which came out in 1950. It was a different world to a 48-49 Jaguar, and I think there's plenty of manufacturers who were making that kind of progress at that time.
I think the aerospace industry in the Second World War also led to the training of an awful lot of very good engineers, and nobody wanted quite as many aeroplanes once the war stopped, so a lot of them drifted into the automotive world.
So after the war was over, you got a lot of innovations in America. And you got these really kind of sexy-looking cars, which were the epitome of the post-war world for most of us who were born.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the whole American shift in skill set, really, and in identity, because before the war, the Americans were making some fantastically engineered cars. I mean, a Packard V12 was arguably the finest car in the world. Brands like Duesenberg and Cord and Miller were very, very advanced engineering. And then after the war, it just didn't exist. They went a completely different route, which was all based on, please look at me, sort of fashionable bling. It was fins and chrome. And they did all that wonderfully, but it was very much the jukebox approach to marketing rather than anything based on sound engineering. And they had very strong engines, the American small block V8 engines, which they've still got today, really. But the rest of it, they just kind of lost the plot on, really, didn't they? And then left it to Europe and the East.
Strong and reliable, but they were pretty crude and inefficient by European standards.
Yeah, hugely so, yeah.
You say by European standards. What did the Europeans start making at the same time then?
The Europeans always made smaller cars, more efficient cars, smaller engines. We had a far greater variety of finer engines that we built our cars around. Their V8 was pretty similar across the board. It was just such a standard item. Mm. But it was a very large engine. It was a heavy, yes, it was a very large engine. It was a heavy engine. It used a lot of fuel. It needed a big car.
Well, also the Europeans and the Brits had a relationship with things called corners, which the Americans didn't they? I mean, they were very much straight line kind of guys.
That's really interesting.
And they just didn't...
That we crafted our cars to go round British bends.
Yeah, and
the Americans were going down motorways.
Exactly. Yeah,
extraordinary. You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, talking about car engineering of the past, present and future, and my special guests this week, Hugo Spowers and Richard Sun. You said earlier that both of you seem to agree that there was something high quality about British engineering. Did that continue after the Second World War?
Absolutely, it did, yes. And as well as the corners on the public roads, we also had corners on our racetracks. Mm. They didn't even have corners there. So they were all their motorsport, which does underpin an awful lot of the development work across the board in mainstream cars. But these great big ovals in America, the corners would take the four corners. You took them pretty much flat out. And you didn't have to go both left and right. They were all corners to the left, whereas we had road racing circuits with multiple different corners of different speeds and cambers and so on. And so all our competitive motorsport was hugely dependent on the chassis dynamics, which just didn't feature in American roadsters, as they called them, that ran at Indianapolis and so on.
So you've got these much more sophisticated cars in Europe. You've got the big engines and the fins in America. And then at some time in the 1960s, a third player, Japan, came into the equation. Why did that happen?
Born out of the motorcycle industry, really. And it's, I think there's a whole national psyche around all this, and that the Japanese have always been really good at detailed, fine engineering, attention to making jewel-like things. And whereas Americans are very good at big, brawny stuff that has got lots of grunt, you know, but perhaps not looking at the in the same way. And it's I think that's representative across the culture, really. And the Japanese were particularly good at small, high revving, very efficient engineering. And the motorcycle industry gave way to cars and all those principles of making things beautifully, which they had to do in motorcycles in a very fine way, was imbued into their car production. And that gave them a product that was very reliable, very efficient. They didn't have the coachwork, the styling, that kind of element, but they certainly had the technical prowess to a different degree.
They got rid of the concept of oil leaks, which was endemic in the sort of British motorcycle industry and the car industry.
Yeah,
I remember as a boy, everybody's garage, there was this little pool of oil on the floor, wasn't there, where overnight it had all seeped out the engine. How did they stop that happening?
Well, it's attention to detail. So they put a lot more attention into the design of all their castings. They were much, much finer. They integrated the castings with the seal much better, so that when it bolted onto another component, you didn't have oil leaking out all the time. This, in turn, led to longer service intervals, so the maintenance costs were lower, and it really put the British industry in the shade, well, the European industry as a whole. But their rise really pretty much matched the decline of the UK's volume manufacturing sector. We were caught unawares, and it took us a while to catch up, and by that stage it was really too late.
I think the Japanese are also, as a culture, were worked together tremendously. It's not really about the brand. It's about the collective pulling together all their expertise. And it was, I think that was reflected in other areas like the Japanese bullet train, which came out in sort of 1963, which was about twice as fast as anything we were producing at the time. And that's companies like Hitachi and Mitsubishi. They were making trains as well as cars, as well as refrigerators and various other things. And they were pooling together, as pulling their resources together in ways that we were very siloed, I think, and very hell-bent on competing with one another rather than working together.
In the 1970s, we suddenly became aware that we were vulnerable if people took away our oil.
Yeah, early 70s, Yom Kippur War.
And yet, I don't know of any innovations, as far as the car industry is concerned, that came out of that in order to shift us away from oil. Were there any, or
were they just blind, or did they think they could always get it either from America or by shooting other?
It was all about it was all about filtering and catalytic converters and things, wasn't it? The early 70s. So this is a very good example in America, because what they did do then is make cars that were incredibly fast, because what they could do is just layer on the performance. So a high performance Plymouth family saloon, a Mopar Hemi Plymouth family saloon from 1970, was faster than the fastest Ferrari you could buy. You know, a Ferrari Daytona was not as quick as a Plymouth Coronet, whatever. And so they could do all that kind of thing. And then they decided that pollution was a real issue. But instead of making the cars smaller, they just put lots of catalytic converters and filters and restricted the airflow and made them fantastically inefficient. And then the performance all fell away, of course. And then they ended up with a sort of a market that was based on Firebird transfers on bonnets rather than things that actually worked.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Stonehenge to Why Pies Were Invented, Why Do Our Dogs Love Us So Much, and the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like, so why not take a lucky dip? Go on, it won't hurt you.
In Europe, we did have a brief interlude, which, I mean, had some lasting effect, looking more seriously at efficiency. Ford did an enormous series of testing of all sorts of makes of cars in their Cologne wind tunnels to try and improve the aerodynamics of cars because of fuel. Mercedes, at that stage in the early 70s, were planning, amazingly, to turn their entire vehicle production over from reciprocating combustion engines to Wankel rotaries.
Just to unpack those four words for me.
Right. Well, an ordinary, a conventional engine has pistons going up and down, and it's called reciprocating because you've got to accelerate the piston up and then slow it down and pull it back down again. It goes up and down. And it's a horrendously unsatisfactory mechanism, really, at its core. A Wankel rotary has just a single three-lobed piston that goes round, and it has three combustion chambers on the three corners. And it's a smoother running device. It can rev more highly. It's much, much smaller and more compact. And Mercedes were going to transfer the entire production over to it. But it was less efficient. It was a much less mature product than a reciprocating combustion engine. And so the oil crisis in 73 put that whole program on pause. And they said, we'll reinstitute the plan once we've achieved within 3% fuel efficiency or something like 3 or 5%. It never happened. So it did have a lasting effect. You do see in the average consumption of cars an improvement, mid-70s onwards. But it's not as if that's been a lasting pressure. I'm afraid we very quickly forgot it. And the engines have continued to get more efficient, but the cars haven't really. We've put on more weight, we've put on more features, we've put on more safety. And so although the engines got more efficient, the cars haven't.
Interesting you say that they've put on more weight. Is it just my impression, or is it the case that cars have been getting bigger and bigger?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real problem. And I think, and I'm not quite sure what the cure or the answer is to that, because every time a new model comes out, the buyer of that model wants something that's bigger and bolder and more thoroughly equipped than the previous version. And so you end up with a Mini today that is incomparably larger than a Mini that came out in 1959. I mean, there's no comparison between them at all. In fact, I think a bigger Mini now is bigger than a Volvo Estate in the 60s.
You know, I mean,
it's and very much heavier. And it happens in the sports car end of the market as well. I mean, really refined examples like the Porsche 911, their high performance model in the early 70s, the RS 2.7, which in its lightweight form was under 900 kilos, I think. And then the equivalent model of that in the range today is more like 1450 kilos. It's half as heavy again. And it's meant to be the same, ultimate lightweight piece in the range.
And this increase in weight and increase in size, is that just customer driven, demand?
I think it is.
Driven.
I mean, the cars are much safer than they were. There's no doubt about that. Do you think you could?
They are safer, but I think it's a fairly lazy excuse because because actually a heavier car isn't safer. If you have a heavier car, you've got a lot more kinetic energy to manage in an accident. But also, there was a study last year from Emission Analytics who did the really good data behind Dieselgate. And they showed that actually the non-exhaust emissions, which are the particulates from tyres and brakes, are over 1,000 times more damaging to human health than the exhaust particulates. And they're pro rata to mass. So if you have twice the mass of car, you have twice the amount of tyre rubber in the air.
And brake particulates as well. It's a really, really significant statistic.
That's extraordinary because for me as a punter, the bad thing about cars has always been the stuff coming out of the exhaust pipe.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that the brakes and the tyres are emitting poisons which are exponentially larger and more dangerous.
Absolutely, and we always worry about how we're going to dispose of tyre carcasses. Nobody ever asks, why is it a carcass? Well, it's because there's an awful lot of it missing around the edge, the tread. Where's it gone? Nobody ever asked where
the British countryside,
Or it's in the snow in the Arctic when they take out their snow samples and they're full of rubbers and plastics.
In Switzerland last year, there was a study that 45% of the microplastics in groundwater and in the lakes are from tyres.
And of course, electric cars are heavy, so they've got bigger brakes and bigger tyres, and they're creating much more of the problem. So it's ironic that we talk about emission-free electric cars when they're actually producing far more serious problems elsewhere in the architecture.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Let's just go back to where we were. We were, let us say, round about 1980, 85. Suddenly there was this dawning realisation that cars were producing an awful lot of dangerous stuff which nobody had ever realised before. How did that happen and how did it affect the car industry?
Well, there were a lot of interesting prototypes and bits of research done by companies. GM did a hydrogen fuel cell van in the late 60s, the electro van. It never went on the public road, and there were always battery prototypes. One could argue, quite frankly, that the battery prototypes produced by the industry were there to show, for PR value, that they were trying, knowing full well that the prototypes they were showing were no threat to the cars they were making because nobody would really want them. And this persisted for a long time. Quite frankly, the investment in research didn't keep up with the need. It dropped off, if anything. And it all changed, though, with Tesla. I think Tesla really made a difference. But it was a matter of the inertia of the industry. The customers are not asking for more sustainable cars. They're asking for the performance. That's what sells the cars. That's what generates the profits. And it's very difficult for a CEO of an industry to focus his attention on what the customers are not asking for.
And gimmicks. They want performance, but they also want TV screens and fascinating graphics and things to show to their friends and all that kind of stuff. And that's Tesla all over. I mean, high performance and an interface. So they're not trying to pretend they've got an interior as good as a top-end Audi or a top-end Mercedes, but they are showing that they've got a technical gadgetry interface that no one can rival.
In my introduction, I talked about how implausible it seemed to me that the battery-driven car was going to be the solution. I guess it was only a decade or so ago that most of us realised we were going to need a solution or some solutions. Why did we go for the battery? Why did it seem to be a much more appealing idea than some alternatives?
The industry has really not been keen to change, quite understandably. It's an incredibly refined and mature industry. Profit margins are tiny. It's very difficult to change direction. They have, quite frankly, been lobbying very hard against the regulations that were an inevitability and delaying them, watering them down. And it eventually came in that we would have 130 gram per kilometre of CO2 tailpipe emissions as an average across your vehicle fleet. It was originally meant to be 120 grams, but it took 5 years longer to get into the legislation, and it was cranked up to 130 grams as a result of a letter from the big three in Germany, Mercedes, VW, Audi and BMW, to say that these regulations would kill their industry. And so Angela Merkel campaigned very hard to delay and reduce that, or increase the threshold they had to achieve. And by the time the regulations did come in, they needed to make zero emission cars, but the only thing they were ready to make was battery electric cars. Mm. Because we've had them, as we saw from our earlier conversation, for as long as we've had petrol cars. We've got better batteries, of course we have. And Tesla have demonstrated just how you can use them to good effect. But it's not difficult to make a battery electric car. The alternative is hydrogen fuel cell technology, and that is genuinely new technology. Mm. The first use of fuel cells in mobility was actually by NASA in the command capsule in space. In Apollo rockets. So they needed less than 1.5 kilowatts of electricity to run the instruments in an Apollo spacecraft. And they couldn't give a monkey's what the price was. So that was the first fuel cells that actually were used anywhere. It's a lot of work to get from 1.5 kilowatts to 100 kilowatts under the bonnet of a car at the price that customers can afford. And by and large, the industry has not been spending the money. So the only option is a battery electric car at the moment. It's not the only practical solution. And the regulations are structured such that selling a zero emission car counts as three cars in working out your fleet average. So even if you make a battery electric car at a loss, it reduces your losses by more than the fines that you'll pay for your tailpipe emissions across the fleet.
Why did we end up with that kind of legislation? That seems a kind of madness.
Well, I think it's probably quite good legislation to bring down the tailpipe emissions, but it's too little too late. And the industry isn't prepared for it. I mean, it's just not ready to respond. And as I say, the battery electric solution is the only one available.
Which brings us on to the hydrogen car. And we must say that this is special pleading. Tell us about your company.
River Simple. Yeah. So we are developing hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. We have been for about 20 years now. And
let's start then by, if you could explain to me what a hydrogen cell vehicle is, because whenever I've mentioned it to my friends, they go, oh, Christ, hydrogen. I wouldn't want hydrogen anywhere near my car. It would just blow up with like a mushroom.
Right. Yes, that's a slight, slightly misunderstanding the issue in that hydrogen bombs are a nuclear reaction. That's nuclear fusion. It's very, very difficult to make it happen. There are some energy companies trying to make it happen for energy supply. We've managed to do it with a hydrogen bomb. Yes, lethal device. I couldn't agree more. Hydrogen as a fuel, though, you can burn, and it's flammable, just like petrol. Any chemical fuel worth its salt it goes bang. Otherwise, not a very good fuel. And you can actually, hydrogen is the lightest element known. It's bound up in the water molecule, H2O, is two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. And so you can pass electricity through water and you can make hydrogen from that. And you've got a very flammable gas that you can burn in a combustion engine. In fact, JCB are turning all their production over to running their diggers on hydrogen through combustion engines. But hydrogen can also be used in what's called a fuel cell, as I was saying that NASA used it, and that's electrolysis in reverse. So, as I said, if you pass electricity through water, out comes hydrogen and oxygen. But you can put hydrogen and oxygen into a fuel cell, and out comes electricity and water. It's exactly the same process, but in reverse. And it's much more efficient than a combustion engine, And so you can use a hydrogen fuel cell in your car to produce electricity. It is still an electric car. It's still driven by an electric motor. But instead of storing all the energy in batteries, you store a lot of energy in a tank of hydrogen and you use that through a fuel cell to create electricity on demand when you need it at the wheels.
Richard, do you buy that? I was trying to find a sophisticated way of saying it, but do you buy that?
I totally buy it. I think there are, and as Hugo has proved too spectacularly with the products that the product that he has, it works in certain ways when a number of variables are put together in a way which creates compound efficiencies, by which we mean lightweight, very, very efficient energy capture under braking and things of that nature. And it does depend on those things in order for it to be as the sensational result that it can be. I think the big win from it is getting rid of batteries. Batteries are incredibly toxic things. They're very, very heavy. Battery electric cars, it's said, are really efficient at one thing, and that's carrying batteries around. They're very, very difficult. Lithium ion batteries are very, very difficult to recycle. There's probably only 5% of them, lithium ion batteries in cars in the world, that have been recycled at the moment. And there's a huge number more that need to be made if we're to get to no petrol cars at all, which is the forecast for 2040, 2050. And at the moment, if you're trying to recycle a battery, they literally have to be manually pulled apart. There's four or five different metals involved between the cathode and the anode. There's electrolytes. They're very dangerous to recycle them. It's quite apart from the mining of the materials in the first place. And that simply isn't the case with the hydrogen fuel cell architecture. You've got, Hugo can explain more, but you've got a bit of platinum involved, I think, in the membrane of the fuel cell, and there's which in itself is very easy to recycle. And Hugo's particular method of gaining these raw materials are based on lease models anyway, where the providers of the materials continue to own those materials, which gets rid of this big issue which has always existed in the motor industry of built-in obsolescence, not only of the car. So a car historically has been designed to date so that you want to replace it as quickly as possible, whereas in Hugo's philosophy, nothing ever dates. You can subtly update it, but the components are always only borrowed or leased. And so in that way, they're made properly in the first place. Everything becomes more efficient and it's a complete closed loop system of efficiency.
Yeah, I think that I probably missed out that part of the history of the motor car where built-in obsolescence came into being, this notion that you wanted as quick turnover from people as you could possibly get. And so you altered the fashion, you altered the size of the fins and sold a new car every year.
It's particularly in America. I mean, the Americans created this whole frenzy, I think. If anyone's to blame, I think it's probably them. But and certainly within the 50s, so, well, not just the 50s, probably from... And they did it even before the war, but certainly post-war, everyone was aware of the difference between a 50 and a 51. I mean, or a 55, a 56, 57 tri-Chevy, that was short trouser schoolboy stuff. You had to know at 100 feet the difference between a 56 and a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air. And what did your dad have? And that was the case across all the brands at the time. But of course, Hugo's philosophy is completely the opposite. And he comes out with some radical and stunning design work that simply stands on its own merits. It doesn't.
I should tell listeners at this point that I met Hugo making a series that I'm doing called Tony Robinson's, I can't even remember what it's called.
Marvelous Machines.
Marvelous Machines. That was a good ad, wasn't it? Tony Robinson's Marvelous Machines, yeah. And we actually went down to the place where Hugo makes these hydrogen cars. And I was so besotted by this car that I phoned Melissa afterwards and said, we must do a show with Hugo. I was supposed to use the car while I was filming, which would have been about 20 minutes. And in fact, you and I spent the whole afternoon driving round mid Wales. I was driving. I wouldn't let you anywhere near the wheel, would I? And it really was quite an extraordinary experience. They're little at the moment. They're in sort of prototype stage. You've only got the two doors, pretty simple. I think there was one windscreen wiper or something like that. Weren't all that many places to put your tissues. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that impressed me so much, and I had never really got this, was that you need a lot of power for a motor car in order, as it were, to get it up to 50 miles an hour. Once you've got it there, once you've got it to cruise, you need far less energy. So Can you explain how you reduce the need for that push at the beginning?
Yes, and it picks up on what Richard was saying about the whole system integration that we're talking about in our car. It is, and this is another reason why we haven't got fuel cells, quite apart from the technology being immature. A fuel cell is so different to a petrol engine. It's a much bigger step from a petrol engine car to a hydrogen car than from a petrol engine car to a battery car. You can easily put a battery into a car that's designed for a petrol engine. It doesn't work like that with hydrogen. And it's not very easy for the industry to stop doing what they're doing altogether and do it in an entirely different way. So what you've said there, Tony, absolutely hits the nail on the head in that your engine in a conventional car is sized for the acceleration you want. If you want better acceleration, you need more power with you to get there, and you end up with a higher top speed whether you like it or not. So we talk about in engineering terms, the acceleration and the top speed are tightly coupled. More of one, you have more of the other. But as you quite rightly point out, when you're cruising on a motorway, and this is true even in something like a Fiesta, at motorway speeds, you're only using about 20% of that peak power. And you're only accelerating for, say, 10% of the working life of the car. So it means the engine is 80% redundant for 90% of its life. And that's true of the transmission too, the gearbox and all the drive shafts and so on, because they're sized for maximum power. And then the chassis is much heavier than it should be, because that's got to hang on to these heavy bits in accidents. That's what drives the chassis weight. And so everything's got heavier, so you need more power. And so it's a vicious circle going round and round. And in our case, one of the observation we made is that we can size the fuel cell only for that 20%, only for the constant cruise. You do have to build the whole architecture of the car, the powertrain, completely differently to be able to do this. And one of the drivers for looking at it like this is fuel cells are rubbish at grunt. You can get a lot of grunt out of a small box with a petrol engine. You can't with a fuel cell. So let's make do with what we've got. So we've got a small fuel cell in our car that's only 10 kilowatts. So to give you some idea, that will just about power 3 domestic kettles. But it'll keep the car, our car, running, cruising at 60 miles an hour until the car runs out of fuel. And you end up with a very light powertrain because we've got no gearbox, no drive shafts, and the fuel cell is only about 20 kilos. And then you can have a very light chassis, and then you need less power in the first place. And then you have a much lighter car, so you have narrower tyres. You've still got the same grip, but because you've got narrower tyres, you don't need power steering, so you get rid of that. And you don't need power-assisted braking because the car's so light. And so all these things have these iterative mass decompounding loops. And all the time, you make the car cheaper, more efficient, and more commercially viable.
Where do you go to get your petrol, your alternative to your petrol? Where do you go to
that? So there are hydrogen pumps now under the canopy, as they call it, where you have a row of petrol pumps and the hydrogen pump on the end, and many more of them on the continent, it has to be said, than there are here. And so the chicken and egg question that comes up all the time is who's going to put in the filling stations before the cars and vice versa. Our observation is that there's over 3 million cars in the UK that operate in a 25-mile radius.
That's, you mean they don't go further from home than that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Commuter cars.
Yeah. Yes. And 48% of households outside cities have two or more cars, one of which tends to be a local car like that. If you design a car for that local use, rather than an intercity capable limo, then you can create a market with just, you don't need 300 filling stations all over the country, you just need one. If you look at a city like Oxford with 200,000 people, if a forecourt puts a filling pump onto its forecourt on the ring road of Oxford, and we put 100 cars into that market for local use, the forecourt's got 100 captive customers from day one. And working with local authorities on refuse collection vehicles and local buses, it all creates more demand. So as a business case, it doesn't need any public subsidy. And you can then roll that out in different locations across the country. So you can grow the skeleton of a nationwide network without ever taking a nationwide gamble. And the great advantage for the customer of all this is that there's no behaviour change required at all. It's just
go to the filling station. You don't have to get your little rubber thing down from the fifth floor and shove it in.
Well, it's as quick as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, if you take some big fuel service station like Fleet Services on the M3 and you think of the number of throughput of cars that go through there that needs plugging into an electric supercharger, I mean, it's inconceivable. Whereas they could do that with hydrogen. And quite apart from the electrical, the demand of the electrical grid, which I think there's some extraordinary study done, wasn't it, that to say for the throughput of cars at Fleet Services would demand the same amount of electricity as the entire city of Guildford in order to try and rival what they achieve at the moment. And hydrogen is as quick to refuel as petrol is, so you don't have any of those.
Richard, stop defending him for a moment.
Sorry, yes. Mm-hmm. No, he's far from a saint.
You are a sceptic, okay? You're looking at what he just said. Where are the cracks?
Oh, well,
where are
the cracks in Hugo's world is simply that we're not used to it. And the fact is that the general public want bigger, bolder, more luxurious, you know, opulent machines. And of course, that which Hugo was just describing is completely the opposite to that. And one of the most salient points in that is that he was saying, yes, it's a fixed stop speed at 60 miles an hour. Why do people buy electric cars? Because they're incredibly quick.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's very, very funny when I've got a very high performance petrol engine car. And whenever I go out in it, the big problem in the mirror is a Tesla. There's some bloke in a Tesla who just has to show you that he's quicker. The fact that he'll run out of steam further down the road or whatever is neither here nor there. It's all about the performance, really. And yet, an electric car is generally very boring to drive. They're point-and-squirt type machines. There's no sort of real driver interaction with it. And so, whereas actually, in fairness to Hugo, his sort of lightweight car, well, you've driven it, you know, it is fun and it's lightweight. But people do want luxury. And they want gizmos, and they want telly screens and hi-fi and space for the dog and the cat and the camping gear and all that kind of stuff.
Hi, I'm taking time out of this excellent chat to tell you how passionate I am about making these history shows for you, and I think it's pretty obvious from my voice most of the time. So if you are enjoying the series, please do leave us a rating or review, and most importantly, please, 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 please follow the series so you know when a new episode's dropped. This also helps to boost our place in the podcast charts. It is, as it were, some kind of, I'm searching for the words, cunning plan. And it ultimately means that we can make more and better episodes for you in the future. Thank you. Now we're back. Let us suppose that Hugo is right and that people can be, or sufficient people can be, persuaded to change their behaviour, as sometimes does happen in the world. You would still have this huge gulf between where we are now in terms of hydrogen car production and where we would need to be. How do we fill that in, given that governments are determined, quite understandably, to reduce emissions really, really fast? How do we get to that place?
From our point of view, we don't see that there's any market resistance at all. We think we've got a willing market. We're out and about with our cars all over the place. And if I could have a pound for every time that somebody said to me, this is what I've been waiting for, battery cars never going to work for me. I mean, as I say, there's no customer behaviour change required. We're aiming to come to market an equivalent cost of ownership, which is not something that a battery car offers at the moment. It's simply a matter of us getting into volume production. And you're absolutely right that governments are fair and square behind the auto industry in their electrification programme using battery electric vehicles. But I understand that. They have to. They can't throw the industry under the bus. The industry's not ready to make hydrogen cars, and we've got to make zero-emission cars. And because of Brexit, of course, rules of origin, we have to demonstrate 55% local content in any cars we make here if we're to export them to the continent. And the battery is such an expensive component of the car that you've got to make the battery here to maintain tariff-free access to the European markets. So government inevitably and understandably is supporting that measure. But I do believe it's an interim. And I also believe that the government will be fair and square behind an alternative zero-emission solution once we're in production and once we're making money and once we're employing people. And then you can expect a very different attitude. I think it's always true that governments around the world support their indigenous auto industry because they employ a lot of people. And in fact, there isn't a single major car company that has been allowed to go bust until we let Rover disappear in the early noughties, since Borgward in the late 1950s. And since then, virtually every major auto manufacturer has at some point been insolvent and has been bailed out, bar Mercedes and Toyota. So there's a strong track record in that happening, but I don't see any resistance from government to what we're doing either. And I expect there'll be a lot more support when we've got to market. But it's at the moment, it's seen as being a bit far off.
But it won't be for everybody, will it? I mean, the people who want high performance, luxury, commodious vehicles are not your immediate customer base. And so
I also ought to defend one point, is that we are targeting that the car that you drove, Tony, is not the car we bring to market, but it'll be a similar car, slightly less sporting. It will be fun to drive and it will be an equivalent cost of ownership. We're not trying to make a fast car. What we can do is acceleration. We could give them the acceleration if the Tesla Rover wants, but that's not the market we're after. We're after the mainstream market because the costs of motoring are going up like you wouldn't believe. And the auto industry, it no longer can make money out of small cars. You look at Ford have dropped the Fiesta from their range. And if Ford won't make a small car, who's going to? And there is this real crisis emerging. 32% of car sales are small cars. And the industry, by and large, is all moving upstream and dropping their low-end products. And so that's the market we're aiming at. We can, though, if we wanted to, give plenty of acceleration. We couldn't, without huge compromise, give high top speed, because that would mean a much, much bigger fuel cell, inefficient, expensive car. And talking of weight and the weight of batteries, I must point out that our car weighs less than the battery does in the Tesla.
Other products are available. I believe you. Whether or not it'll work, whether or not we are living in the correct universe where this transformation will happen, I don't know. Personally, I am convinced that we can't keep going down the battery road for very much longer as far as towns and cities are concerned. I just don't see how we can give all the energy that's required in order to do that.
Could I make a little defence of battery cars as well?
Yes, of course you can.
I think it is probably quite important to say that hydrogen is a space for battery cars. They're terribly important. They made a big difference already. And there is a role for them in an ongoing sense. But it's short range and it's regular duty cycles. And it's the long range and irregular, spontaneous use that we really need hydrogen for. But there's a role for both. We don't argue about solar PV or wind turbines, which one's going to win that renewable energy race. They're just different and we need them both. And the same is true of batteries and hydrogen.
If we're stuck with batteries, is there any way we can make them better?
Well, I think half the problem is that it's generally accepted that the lithium-ion battery is about as efficient as it's going to get, and there's not going to be some dramatic change in technology in that architecture. It may be that there's a whole new battery around the corner that we haven't come across yet, but we don't know what that is. There's other forms or ways of recharging cars, not least wireless recharging, the same sort of thing that you use with your mobile phone. But, for example, there's technologies that exist that allow cars apparently to charge as they go around the M25 wirelessly from an subsurface charging infrastructure. Hugely expensive, still in its nascent stages of development. It's a long way off. So it doesn't alter the fact that there's an interim problem. And we don't really know what the solution is to that.
Sorry to disappoint people, but I don't think it's going to be a fundamental improvement in battery technology at all, and it can't be. They're going to get 10, 20% more energy dense, but no more than that, unless we discover a new element between lithium and hydrogen in the periodic table. And lithium is number three after hydrogen and helium. And we know the electrochemistry of lithium. It's the lightest thing that can do what a battery does. So until we find a new element, we're stuck with what we've got.
One final question, which I always ask, a cunning plan. Hugo, what is your cunning plan for the future of the car industry?
I think the biggest change the industry needs to see is not in technology, but in business model. Mm. I think the future of the car industry is they've got to stop selling cars. In fact, I think that all cars should remain on the balance sheet of car companies for their whole life, and they should sell the service of those cars.
So you're talking about leasing?
Well, yes, but not a lease, because in our view, the contract would include a mileage rate like a usage rate on a phone, so it covers things like the fuel. And at the end of the contract, the car comes back to us. But unlike a lease, we don't sell it in second-hand trade. We provide a second, a third, a fourth-hand customer. And in that case, our interests are low running costs and longevity. It's a revenue-generating asset. The longer it lasts and the more efficient it is, because we're paying for the fuel, the more profitable it is for us to manufacture. If we sell cars, we make more money by selling more cars. Our interests are obsolescence and high running costs, the opposite of what the customer wants. And we profit from maximizing resource consumption. And I don't see how we can ever have a sustainable industrial system based on rewarding industry for the opposite of what we're trying to achieve.
Richard?
Definitely to get weight down. I think everyone who drives a car needs to realize that lightweight is not only cool, it's a wonderful thing, but it creates a wonderful driving experience as well, and compound efficiencies. And if we can get away from bigger and fatter is better as the default psychology, I think that it enables everything else to happen. But unless that shift somehow takes place, then dreams like Hugo's will always be struggling against the tide a little bit.
Thank you both very much. I really enjoyed that podcast, and I hope the listeners did too. Happy driving.
Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast is produced by Melissa Fitzgerald and is a Zinc Media production.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.